Chapter 12. Is that a symbol?
Sure it is.
That's one of the most common questions in class, and that's the answer I generally give. Is that a symbol? Sure. Why not? It's the next question where things get hairy. What does it mean? What does it stand for? When someone asks about meaning, I usually come back with something clever like, well, what do you think? Everyone thinks I'm either being a wise guy or ducking responsibility, but neither is the case. Seriously, what do you think it stands for? Because that's probably what it does, at least for you. Here's the problem with symbols. People expect them to mean something, not just any something, but one something in particular. Exactly, maximum. You know what? It doesn't work like that. Oh, sure, there are some symbols that work straightforwardly. A white flag means, I give up, don't shoot. Or it means, we come in peace. See, even in a fairly clear-cut case, we can't pin down a single meaning, although they're pretty close. So some symbols do have a relatively limited range of meanings, but in general, a symbol can't be reduced to standing for only one thing. If they can, it's not symbolism. It's allegory. Here's how allegory works. Things stand for other things on a one-for-one basis. Back in 1678, John Bunyan wrote an allegory called The Pilgrim's Progress. In it, the main character, Christian, is trying to journey to the celestial city, while along the way, he encounters such distractions as the Slough of Despond, the Primrose Path, Vanity Fair, and the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Other characters have names like Faithful, Evangelist, and the Giant Despair. Their names indicate their qualities, and in the case of Despair, his size as well. Allegories have one mission to accomplish: convey a certain message, in this case, the quest of the devout Christian to reach heaven. If there is ambiguity or a lack of clarity regarding that one-to-one correspondence between the emblem, the figurative construct, and the thing it represents, then the allegory fails because the message is blurred. Such simplicity of purpose has its advantages. George Orwell's Animal Farm, 1945, is popular among many readers precisely because it's relatively easy to figure out what it all means. Orwell is desperate for us to get the point, not a point. Revolutions inevitably fail, he tells us, because those who come to power are corrupted by it and reject the values and principles they initially embraced. Symbols, though, generally don't work so neatly. The thing referred to is likely not reducible to a single statement, but will more probably involve a range of possible meanings and interpretations. Consider the problem of the cave. In his masterful novel, A Passage to India, 1924, E.M. Forster has as his central incident a possible assault in a cave. All through the first half of the work, the Maribor Caves hover over the story. They keep being referred to. They're out there, remarkable in some ill-defined way, mysterious. Our independent and progressive heroine, Adela Quested, does that name strike you as symbolic at all? Wishes to see them. So Dr. Aziz, an educated Indian physician, arranges an outing. The caves turn out to be not quite as advertised, isolated in a barren wasteland, unadorned, strange, uncanny. Mrs. Moore, Adela's mother-in-law-to-be, has a very nasty experience in the first of the caves when she suddenly feels oppressively crowded and physically threatened by the others who have joined her. Adela notices that all sound is reduced to a hollow, booming noise, so that a voice or a footfall or the striking of a match results in this booming negation. Mrs. Moore, understandably, has had enough of caves, so Adela does a bit of poking around on her own. In one of the caves, she suddenly becomes alarmed, believing that, well, something is going on. When next we see her, she has fled the scene, running and falling down the hillside to collapse into the arms of the racist English community she so vehemently criticized before. Badly bruised and scraped and poked by cactus spines, She isn't shocked and utterly convinced that she was assaulted in the cave and that Aziz must have been her assailant. Was that cave symbolic? You bet. Of what? That, I fear, is another matter. We want it to mean something, don't we? More than that, we want it to mean something, one thing for all of us and for all time. That would be easy, convenient, manageable for us. But that handiness would result in a net loss. The novel would cease to be what it is, a network of meanings and significations that permits a nearly limitless range of possible interpretations. The meaning of the cave isn't lying on the surface of the novel. Rather, it waits somewhere deeper. And part of what it requires of us is to bring something of ourselves to the encounter. If we want to figure out what a symbol might mean, we have to use a variety of tools on it. Questions, experience, pre-existing knowledge. What else is Forster doing with caves? What are other outcomes in the text, or uses of caves in general that we can recall? What else can we bring to bear on this cave that might yield up meaning? So, here we go. Caves in general. First, consider our past. Our earliest ancestors, or those who had weather issues, lived in caves. Some of them left us some pretty nifty drawings, while others left behind piles of bones and spots charred from that great discovery, fire. But the point here might be, no guarantees, of course, that the cave, on some level, suggests a connection to the most basic and primitive elements in our natures. At the far end of the spectrum, we might be reminded of Plato, who in the Parable of the Cave section of the Republic, 5th century BC, gives us an image of the cave as consciousness and perception. Each of these predecessors might provide possible meanings for our situation. The security and shelter suggested by some Neolithic memory of caves probably won't work here, but something along the lines of Plato's cave interior may. Perhaps this cave experience has something to do with Adela getting in touch with the deepest levels of her consciousness, and perhaps being frightened by what she finds there. Now, Forster's use of the caves. The locals cannot explain or describe the caves. Aziz, a grand promoter of them, must finally admit he knows nothing of them, having never visited the site, while Professor Godball, who has seen them, describes their effect only in terms of what does not cause it. To each of the characters' questions, are they picturesque? Are they historically significant? He offers a cryptic no. To his Western audience and even to Aziz, this set of responses is not helpful. Godball's message might be that the caves must be experienced before they can be understood, or that every person's caves are different. Such a position might be borne out by the example of Mrs. Moore's unpleasant encounter in a different cave. Throughout the early portions of the novel, she has been impatient with other people and resentful of having them, their views, their assumptions, their physical presence, forced on her. One of the ironies of her Indian experience is that in a landscape so vast, the psychological space is so small. She came all this way and can't get away from life, England, people, death closing in on her. When she gets inside the cave, a crush of people threatens her. The jostling and brushing seem overtly hostile in their dark enclosure. Something unidentified but unpleasant. She can't tell if it belongs to a bat or an infant, but it's organic and not nice, rubs across her mouth. Her heartbeat becomes oppressive and she can't breathe, so she flees the cave as quickly as she can and takes a good while to calm down. In her case, the cave seems to force her into contact with her deepest personal fears and anxieties, other people, ungovernable sensations, children, and fecundity. There is also the suggestion that India itself threatens her, since all the people aside from Adela and herself in the cave are Indians. While she has tried to be Indian, to be comfortable and understanding of the natives in ways other members of the ruling British have not been, she can hardly be said to have mastered the Indian experience. So it may be that what she runs into in the darkness is the fraudulence of her attempt to be Indian. On the other hand, maybe she doesn't have an encounter with something at all. Perhaps what she meets in the cave is instead nothingness, albeit some years before Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, and the existentialists of the 1950s and 1960s articulate the dichotomy between, in Sartre's terms, being and nothingness. Could it be that what she finds in the cave isn't death necessarily, but the experience of the void? I think it quite possible, if by no means certain. So what does Adela's cave stand for? She has, or seems to have, all of the responses that Mrs. Moore does, although hers are different. As a virgin on the edge of spinsterhood who has been shipped halfway around the world to marry a man she doesn't love, she has some very understandable anxieties about matrimony and sex. In fact, her last conversation before entering the cave is with Aziz regarding his own married life, and her questions are probing and even inappropriate. Perhaps this conversation brings on her hallucination, if that is what it is, or perhaps it provokes Aziz or some third party, their guide, for instance, into whatever he does, if anyone does anything. For Adela, the horror of her cave experience and its booming echo ride roughshod over her soul until she recants her testimony against Aziz during the trial. Once the mayhem dies down and she is safely away from the Indians who have hated her and the English who now hate her, she announces that the echo has stopped. What does this suggest? The cave may bring on or point up a variety of inauthentic experience, another existential concept. That is, Adela is confronted by the hypocrisy of her life and her reasons for coming to India or agreeing to marry Ronnie, her fiancé, by her failure to take responsibility for her own existence. Or it may represent a breach of the truth, in a more traditional philosophical tradition, or a confrontation with terrors she has denied and can only exorcise by facing them, or something else. For Aziz, too, the caves speak through their aftermath, of the perfidy of the English, of the falseness of his subservience, of his need to assert responsibility for his own life. It may be that Adela does panic in the face of nothingness, only recovering herself when she takes responsibility by recanting in the witness box. Perhaps it's all about nothing more than her own self-doubts, her own psychological or spiritual difficulties. Perhaps it is racial in some way. The only thing we are sure of about the cave as symbol is that it keeps its secrets. That sounds as if I'm punting, but I'm not. What the cave symbolizes will be determined to a large extent by how the individual reader engages the text. Every reader's experience of every work is unique, largely because each person will emphasize various elements to differing degrees, and those differences will cause certain features of the text to become more or less pronounced. We bring an individual history to our reading. A mix of previous readings, to be sure, but also a history that includes but is not limited to educational attainment, gender, race, class, faith, social involvement, and philosophical inclination. These factors will inevitably influence what we understand in our reading, and nowhere is this individuality clearer than in the matter of symbolism. The problem of symbolic meaning is further compounded when we look at a number of writers emphasizing various distinct elements for a given symbol. As an example, let's consider three rivers. Mark Twain gives us the Mississippi, Hart Crane, the Hudson East Mississippi / generic American, and T.S. Eliot, the Thames. All three are American writers, all from the Midwest, two from Missouri, no less. Do you suppose there's any chance of their rivers standing for the same thing? In The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, 1885, Twain sends Huck and the escaped slave Jim down the Mississippi on a raft. The river is a little bit of everything in the novel. At the beginning, it floods, killing livestock and people, including Huck's father. Jim is using the river to escape to freedom, but his escape is paradoxical, since it carries him deeper and deeper into slave territory. The river is both danger and safety, since the relative isolation from land and detection is offset by the perils of river travel on a makeshift conveyance. On a personal level, the river/raft provides the platform on which Huck, a white boy, can get to know Jim not as a slave, but as a man. And of course, the river is really a road, and the raft trip a quest that results in Huck growing to maturity and understanding. He knows himself well enough at the end that he will never return to childhood and Hannibal and bossy women, so he lights out for the territories. Now, take Hart Crane's poem sequence, The Bridge, 1930, which plays with rivers and bridges throughout. He begins with the East River, spanned by the Brooklyn Bridge. From there, the river grows into the Hudson and on into the Mississippi, which, for Crane, metonymically represents all American rivers. Interesting things begin happening in the poem. The bridge connects the two pieces of land cut off from one another by the river, while it has the effect of bisecting the stream. The river, meanwhile, does separate the land on a horizontal axis, but connects along a vertical axis, making it possible for people at one end to travel to the other. The Mississippi becomes of central symbolic importance for Crane because of its immense length, bringing the northernmost and southernmost parts of the nation together while making it virtually impossible to move from east to west without some means of traversing the river. His meanings are quite different from those of Twain. Together, the river and the bridge constitute an image of total connection. And Eliot? Eliot uses the River Thames prominently in The Wasteland, written in the immediate aftermath of World War I and of a more personal breakdown. His river carries the detritus of a dying civilization and features, among other things, a rat trailing along the bank. The river is slimy, dirty, its famous bridge falling down, in nursery rhyme form, abandoned by its nymphs. The river is shorn of grandeur, grace, and divinity. In the poem's past, Queen Elizabeth and the Earl of Leicester carry on their dalliance on the water, but their modern counterparts are merely sordid and seedy. Clearly, Eliot's river is symbolic. Equally clearly, it symbolizes things having to do with the corruption of modern life and collapse of Western civilization, which do not come into play with either Twain or Crane. Of course, Eliot's work is heavily ironic, and as we'll discuss later, everything changes when irony climbs aboard. You will have noticed in these last pages that I assert meaning for these uses of caves and symbols with considerable authority, and indeed I have a pretty strong grasp of what they mean for me. The authority I bring to these readings is that of my own background and experience. I incline, for instance, toward a reading of The Wasteland based on its historical context, a historicist reading, if you will, in which the poem cannot be divorced from the recent war and its aftermath. But not everyone comes at the poem from that angle. Others may approach it chiefly in formal terms or on biographical grounds, as a response to violent personal and marital upheaval. These and many other approaches are not only valid, but produce readings of considerable insight. In fact, I have learned a great deal not only about the poem, but about my own shortcomings from alternative approaches. One of the pleasures of literary scholarship lies in encountering different and even conflicting interpretations, since the great work allows for a considerable range of possible interpretations. Under no circumstances, in other words, should you take my pronouncements on these works as definitive. The other problem with symbols is that many readers expect them to be objects and images rather than events or actions. Action can also be symbolic. Robert Frost is probably the champion of the symbolic action, although his uses of it are so sly that resolutely literal readers can miss the symbolic level entirely. In his poem, Mowing, 1913, for instance, the activity of mowing a field with a scythe, which, mercifully, you and I will never have to do, is first and foremost just what it is, a description of sweeping a field clean of standing hay one stroke at a time. We also notice, though, that mowing carries weight beyond its immediate context, seeming to stand in for labor generally, or for the solitary business of living one's life, or for something else beyond itself. Similarly, the speaker's account of his recent actions in After Apple Picking, 1914, suggests a point in life as well as a point in the season, and the memory of picking, from the lingering sense of the swaying ladder and the imprint of the rung on his footsoles to the impression of apples on his retinas, suggests the wear and tear of the activity of living on the psyche. Again, the non-symbolic thinker can see this as a beautiful evocation of an autumnal moment, which it is, and pleasurably so. But there is more than just that going on. It may be a little more obvious with the moment of decision in his The Road Not Taken, 1916, which is why it is the universal graduation poem. But symbolic action can also be found in poem after poem, from the terrible accident in Out Out to climbing in Birches, 1916. So, what are you to do? You can't simply say, well, it's a river, so it means X, or apple picking, so it means Y. On the other hand, you can say this could sometimes mean X or Y or even Z, so let's keep that in mind to see which one, if either, happens here. Any past experience of literary rivers or labor may be helpful as well. Then you start breaking down the work at hand into manageable pieces. Associate freely, brainstorm, take notes. Then you can organize your thoughts, grouping them together under headings, rejecting or accepting different ideas or meanings as they seem to apply. Ask questions of the text. What's the writer doing with this image, this object, this act? What possibilities are suggested by the movement of the narrative or the lyric? And most important, what does it feel like it's doing? Reading literature is a highly intellectual activity, but it also involves affect and instinct to a large degree. Much of what we think about literature, we feel first. Having instincts, though, doesn't automatically mean they work at their highest level. Dogs are instinctual swimmers, but not every pup hits the water understanding what to do with that instinct. Reading is like that too. The more you exercise the symbolic imagination, the better and quicker it works. We tend to give writers all the credit, but reading is also an event of the imagination. Our creativity, our inventiveness, encounters that of the writer. And in that meeting, we puzzle out what she means, what we understand her to mean, what uses we can put her writing to. Imagination isn't fantasy. That is to say, we can't simply invent meaning without the writer. Or if we can, we ought not to hold her to it. Rather, a reader's imagination is the act of one creative intelligence engaging another. So, engage that other creative intelligence. Listen to your instincts. Pay attention to what you feel about the text. It probably means something. Chapter 13. It's All Political. Nowadays, we think of A Christmas Carol as a private morality play and a nice Christmas tale to boot. But in 1843, Dickens was actually attacking a widely held political belief, hiding his criticism in the story of a wretched miser who is saved by spiritual visitations. There was a theory afoot at that time, left over from the Puritanism of the previous two centuries, and promulgated most forcefully by the British social thinker Thomas Malthus, that in helping the poor, or in increasing food production to feed more people, we would in fact encourage an increase in the number of the impoverished, who would, among other things, simply procreate faster to take advantage of all that surplus gruel. Dickens caricatures this Malthusian thinking in Scrooge's insistence that he wants nothing to do with the destitute, and if they would rather starve than live in the poorhouse or in debtor's prison, then by golly, they had best hurry up and do it and decrease the excess population. Scrooge actually says that. What a guy. Even if you've never heard of Thomas Malthus, when you read A Christmas Carol or see one of the umpteen versions of it on screen, you can tell something is going on beyond the story. If nasty old Scrooge were one of a kind, just a single, selfish, embittered man, if he were the only man in England who needed to learn this lesson, the tale would not resonate with us as it does. It's not generally in the way of parables, which Carol is, to treat anomalies. No, Dickens picks Scrooge not because he's unique, but because he's representative, because there's something of Scrooge in us and in society. We can have no doubt that the story is meant to change us and through us to change society. Some of Scrooge's pronouncements early in the story are almost verbatim from Malthus or his Victorian descendants. Dickens is a social critic, but he's a sneaky one, remaining so consistently entertaining that we may not notice that a major point of his work is to critique social shortcomings. At the same time, you have to be almost willfully blind to read that story and see only Marley's ghost, three spirits, and Tiny Tim to fail to notice that the tale attacks one way of thinking about our social responsibility and valorizes another. Concerning politics in literary texts, here's what I think. I hate political writing. Novels, plays, poems. They don't travel well, don't age well, and generally aren't much good in their own time and place, however sincere they may be. I speak here of literature whose primary intent is to influence the body politic. For instance, those works of socialist realism, one of the great misnomers of all time, of the Soviet era, in which the plucky hero figures out a way to increase production and thereby meet the goals of the 5-year plan on the collective farm. What I once heard the great Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes characterize as the love affair between a boy and girl and a tractor. Overtly political writing can be one-dimensional, simplistic, reductionist, preachy, dull. The political writing I personally dislike is programmatic, pushing a single cause or concern or party position, or it's tied into a highly topical situation that doesn't transfer well out of its own specific time and place. Ezra Pound's politics, for instance, a mixture of anti-Semitism and authoritarianism that made Italian fascism congenial to him, are repugnant to any thinking person, and to the extent that they find expression in his poetry, they destroy everything they touch. But even if they weren't so hideous, their use in his verse tends to be clumsy and heavy-handed, too obviously programmatic. When he starts droning on in the cantos about the evils brought about by usura, for instance, eyes glaze over and minds wander. We in the age of credit cards are just not that hopped up about supposed ills of the culture of lending and borrowing between the world wars. The same thing happens with a lot of those left-wing plays of the 1930s. They may have been fine as rallying cries in their day, but as works of lasting interest, they work for lots of us only as cultural anthropology. I love political writing. Writing that engages the realities of its world, that thinks about human problems, including those in the social and political realm, that addresses the rights of persons and the wrongs of those in power, can be not only interesting, but hugely compelling. In this category, we get the grimy London of Dickens' late work, the fabulous postmodern novels of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Toni Morrison, the plays of Henrik Ibsen and George Bernard Shaw, Seamus Heaney's poetry of the Northern Irish Troubles, and the feminist struggles with a poetic tradition of Evan Boland and Adrienne Rich and Audre Lorde. Nearly all writing is political on some level. D.H. Lawrence's work is profoundly political, even when it doesn't look like it, even when he is less overt than in Women in Love, where he has a character say of a robin that it looks like a little Lloyd George of the air. I'm not quite sure how a robin resembles the then Prime Minister, but it's clear Lawrence didn't approve, and the character clearly shares her creator's politics. I also know that's not the real political element in that novel. No, his real political contribution is in setting a radical individualism in conflict with established institutions. Lawrence's people keep refusing to behave, to submit to convention, to act in a way that conforms to expectations, even expectations of other nonconformists. In Women in Love, he pillories the bohemianism of the artsy sets of his day, whether the Bloomsbury Circle or the group that Lady Ottoline Morell, the self-consciously bohemian patroness of the arts, gathered around herself. Their avant-gardism merely constitutes another kind of conventionality for him, a way of being chic or in, whereas his heroic ideal goes its solitary way even though it outrage friend as well as foe and confound lover as well as stranger. That radical individualism is politically charged in Lawrence, just as it is in Walt Whitman, whom he admired greatly, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, in their very different ways. Indeed, you could argue that the role of the individual is always politically charged, that matters of autonomy and free will and self-determination always drag in the larger society, if only tangentially. Someone like Thomas Pynchon, although, as Chapter 1 suggests, it's not clear there is anyone like Pynchon except Pynchon, who seems on one level to be hiding from the body politic, is profoundly political in his concern over the individual's relationship to America. Or here's someone whose stories you may not have thought of as inevitably political, Edgar Allan Poe. His tales The Mask of the Red Death, 1842, and The Fall of the House of Usher, 1839, both deal with a stratum of society most of us only get to read about, the nobility. In the former, the prince, in the midst of a terrible plague, gathers his friends and associates for a party, at which he locks them away from the afflicted and poor society outside the walls of the palace. The titular scourge finds them anyway, and by morning they're all dead. In the latter, the host, Roderick Usher, and his sister Madeline are the last survivors of an old aristocratic family. Living in a decaying mansion surrounded by a forbidding landscape, they are themselves decaying. She has a progressive wasting disease, while he is prematurely aged and decrepit, his hair nearly gone and his nerves shot. He behaves, moreover, like a madman, and there is more than a slight hint at incestuous closeness between brother and sister. In both of these tales, Poe offers criticism of the European class system, which privileges the unworthy and the unhealthy, where the entire atmosphere is corrupt and decaying, where the results are madness and death. The landscape of Usher resembles no part of America Poe ever saw. Even the appellation House of Usher suggests European monarchy and aristocracy, the houses of Bourbon or Hanover, for instance, rather than an American place or family. Roderick has buried his sister alive, possibly knowing she wasn't dead, certainly becoming aware of it as time in the story passes. Now, why would he do a thing like that? When she escapes, having clawed her way out, she falls into his arms and they collapse to the floor, both dead. The narrator narrowly escapes before the house itself pulls apart and crashes into the black and lurid tarn at its base. If all of that doesn't suggest an unhealthy, unholy, and distinctly un-American relationship between brother and sister, then one of us is missing something. Edgar Allan Poe, super patriot? Okay, you're right. That may be going too far. Still, he implicitly believes that what Europe represents is degraded and decaying, and these are not the only examples. Moreover, Poe suggests strongly that this is the inevitable and even just outcome of a corrupt social organization. And that, dear friends, is political. Ready for another example? How about Rip Van Winkle? I'm sure you have doubts. Tell me what you remember. Okay. Rip Van Winkle, who's lazy and not a great provider for his family, goes hunting. Actually, he's really just getting away from his nagging wife. He meets some odd characters playing ninepins, with whom he drinks a little bit and falls asleep. When he wakes up, his dog is gone, and his gun has rusted and fallen apart. He has white hair and a beard a mile long and very stiff joints. He makes his way back to town and finds out he's been asleep for 20 years, and his wife is dead and everything has changed, including the signs at the hotel. And that's pretty much the story. Pretty much. Nothing very political in that, right? Except that we need to consider two questions. One, what does it mean that Dame Van Winkle is dead? Two, how does that connect with the change of George's on the hotel sign? During the 20 years he's been away, the American Revolution has happened. The picture of British King George has been transformed by the proprietors into that of our George, Washington, although with the same face. There's a liberty cap atop the flagpole, which carries a new flag, and the tyrant, Dame Van Winkle, is dead. Rip nearly gets attacked when he says he's loyal to the old George, but once that gets straightened out, he finds out he's free and he likes it. So, everything's better? Definitely not. Irving is writing in 1819 and is observant enough to know that liberty brought with it some problems. Things have become a little run down. The hotel has some broken windows and needs a facelift, and the town and its people are generally a little more ragged than they were before the war. But there's a kind of energy that drives them, a certainty that their lives are their own, and nobody, by golly, is going to boss them around. They speak their minds and do what they want. And tyranny and absolute rule are dead. In other words, this slightly scruffy assemblage of people is on the way to defining for itself what it means to be American and free. So, not everything is better, but the things that really matter, freedom, self-determination, they are better. How can I be so sure that Irving means to imply all that? Part of his protective coloration is as this rather naive, rustic spinner of tales, but that's not him. It's pure disguise. Washington Irving was a man of great sophistication who studied law, was admitted to the bar, served in Spain as a diplomat, wrote histories as well as fiction, traveled widely. Does that sound like a man who didn't understand what his narrative signified? His ostensible narrator, Diedrich Knickerbocker, is a jolly companion who spins out these tales of his Dutch ancestors without seeing all the implications. Irving saw them, though. He knew, moreover, that with Rip and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, 1819, he was creating an American consciousness in literature, a thing that hadn't existed prior to his time. Like Poe, he sets himself up in opposition to European literary tradition, offering instead a body of work that could only come from an American, and that features and celebrates freedom from its former colonial power. So is every literary work political? I can't go that far. Some of my more political colleagues may tell you, yes, that every work is either part of the social problem or part of the solution. They'll give it to you with rather more subtlety than that, but that's the gist. I do think, though, that most works must engage with their own specific period in ways that can be called political. Let's say this. Writers tend to be men and women who are interested in the world around them. That world contains many things, and on the level of society, part of what it contains is the political reality of the time. Power structures, relations among classes, issues of justice and rights, interactions between the sexes and among various racial and ethnic constituencies. That's why political and social considerations often find their way onto the page in some guise, even when the result doesn't look terribly political. An example. When Sophocles is a very old man, he finally writes the middle third of his Theban trilogy of plays, Oedipus at Colonus, 406 BC, in which the old and frail Oedipus arrives at Colonus and receives the protection of the Athenian king, Theseus. Theseus is everything we might want in a ruler: strong, wise, gentle, tough when necessary, determined, cool-headed, compassionate, loyal, honest. Theseus protects Oedipus from potential harm and guides him to the sacred spot where the old man is fated to die. Is that political? I think so. You see, Sophocles is writing this not only at the end of his life, but at the end of the 5th century BC, which is to say at the end of the period of Athenian greatness. The city-state is threatened from the outside by Spartan aggression and from the inside by leaders who, whatever their virtues, sure aren't Theseus. What he's saying is, in effect, we could really use a leader like Theseus again. Maybe he could get us out of this mess and keep Athens from total ruin. Then outsiders, Creon in the play, the Spartans in reality, wouldn't be trying to overrun us. Then we'd still be strong and just and wise. Does Sophocles actually say any of these things? No, of course not. He's old, not senile. You say these things openly, they give you hemlock or something. He doesn't have to say them, though. Everyone who sees the play can draw his own conclusions. Look at Theseus. Look at whatever leader you have near to hand. Look at Theseus again. Or words to that effect. See? Political. All this matters. Knowing a little something about the social and political milieu out of which a writer creates can only help us understand her work, not because that milieu controls her thinking, but because that is the world she engages when she sits down to write. When Virginia Woolf writes about women of her time only being permitted a certain range of activities, we do her and ourselves a great disservice by not seeing the social criticism involved. For instance, in Mrs. Dalloway, 1925, Lady Bruton invites Richard Dalloway, a member of Parliament, and Hugh Whitbread, who has a position at court, to luncheon. Her purpose is to dictate to them material she wants to see introduced into legislation and sent as a letter to the Times, all the while protesting that she's merely a woman who doesn't understand these matters as a man would. What Woolf shows us is a very capable, if not entirely lovable, woman using the fairly limited Richard and the completely doltish Hugh to make her point in a society which would not take the point seriously if it was seen as coming directly from her. In the years after the Great War, the scene reminds us, ideas were judged on the basis of the class and gender of the person putting them forward. Woolf handles all of this so subtly that we may not think of it as political, but it is. It always, or almost always, is. Chapter 14. Yes, she's a Christ figure too. This may surprise some of you, but we live in a Christian culture. What I mean is that since the preponderance of cultural influences has come down to us from European early settlers, and since those early settlers inflicted their values on the benighted cultures they encountered, benighted from the Old English meaning anyone darker than myself, those inflicted values have gained ascendancy. This is not to say that all citizens of this great republic are Christians, any more than that they are all great republicans. I once heard a well-known Jewish professor of composition speak about walking into her very first final examination in college only to be confronted with this question: discuss the Christian imagery in Billy Budd. It simply never occurred to her professor back in the 1950s that Christian imagery might be alien territory for some students. Institutions of higher learning can no longer blithely assume that everyone in class is a Christian, and if they do, it's at their own risk. Still, no matter what your religious beliefs, to get the most out of your reading of European and American literatures, knowing something about the Old and New Testaments is essential. Similarly, if you undertake to read literature from an Islamic or a Buddhist or a Hindu culture, you're going to need knowledge of other religious traditions. Culture is so influenced by its dominant religious systems that whether a writer adheres to the beliefs or not, the values and principles of those religions will inevitably inform the literary work. Often those values will not be religious in nature, but may show themselves in connection with the individual's role within society, or humankind's relation to nature, or the involvement of women in public life. Although, as we have seen, just as often, religion shows up in the form of allusions and analogues. When I read an Indian novel, for example, I'm often aware, if only dimly, of how much I'm missing due to my ignorance of the various religious traditions of the subcontinent. Since I'd like to get more out of my reading, I've worked to reduce that ignorance, but I still have a way to go. Okay, so not everyone is a Christian around these parts, nor do those who would say they are necessarily have more than a nodding familiarity with the New Testament, aside from John 3:16, which is always beside the goalposts at football games. But in all probability, they do know one thing. They know why it's called Christianity. Okay, so it's not the most profound insight ever, but it matters. A lot. Northrop Frye, one of the great literary critics, said in the 1950s that biblical typology, the comparative study of types between the Old and New Testaments, and by extension out into literature, was a dead language, and things haven't improved since then. While we may not be all that well-versed in types and archetypes from the Bible, we generally recognize, whatever our religious affiliation, some of the features that make Christ who he is. Whether you do or not, this list may be helpful. 1. Crucified. Wounds in the hands, feet, side, and head. 2. In agony. 3. Self-sacrificing. 4. Good with children. 5. Good with loaves, fishes, water, wine. 6. 33 years of age when last seen. 7. Employed as carpenter. 8. Known to use humble modes of transportation, feet or donkeys preferred. 9. Believed to have walked on water. 10. Often portrayed with arms outstretched. 11. Known to have spent time alone in the wilderness. 12. Believed to have had a confrontation with the devil, possibly tempted. 13. Last seen in the company of thieves. 14. Creator of many aphorisms and parables. 15. Buried, but arose on the third day. 16. Had disciples, 12 at first, although not all equally devoted. 17. Very forgiving. 18. Came to redeem an unworthy world. You may not subscribe to this list, may find it too glib, but if you want to read like a literature professor, you need to put aside your belief system, at least for the period during which you read, so you can see what the writer is trying to say. As you're reading that story or poem, religious knowledge is helpful, although religious belief, if too tightly held, can be a problem. We want to be able to identify features in stories and see how they are being used. In other words, we want to be analytical. Say we're reading a book, a novel, short novel, say, and let's say this short novel has a man in it, a man no longer young, in fact old, as well as very poor and engaged in a humble profession. Not carpentry, say, but fishing. Jesus had some dealings with fishermen too, and is often connected symbolically with fish. So that's a point of similarity. And the old fisherman hasn't had much good luck for a long time, so no one believes in him. In general, there's a lot of doubt and non-belief in our story. But one young boy believes in him. Sadly, though, the boy isn't allowed to accompany the fisherman anymore, because everyone, the boy's parents included, think the old man is bad luck. There's a second point of similarity. He's good with children, or at least one child. And he has one disciple. And this old man is very good and pure. So that's another point. Because the world he lives in is rather sullied and unworthy. Fallen, even. During his solitary fishing trip, the old man hooks into a big fish that takes him far out beyond his known limits, to where the sea becomes a wilderness. He's all alone, and he's put through great physical suffering, during which even he begins to doubt himself. His hands are ripped up by the struggle. He thinks he's broken something in his side. But he bucks himself up with aphorisms like, "A man is not made for defeat. A man can be destroyed, but not defeated." Inspiring things like that. Somehow he can endure this whole episode, which lasts 3 days, and which finally makes it seem to those on land that he's dead. His great fish is ruined by sharks, but he manages to drag this huge, ruined skeleton back to port. His return is like a resurrection. He has to walk up a hill from the water to his shack, and he carries his mast, which looks like a man carrying a cross from a certain point of view. Then he lies on his bed, exhausted by his struggles, his arms thrown out in the position of crucifixion, showing his damaged, raw hands. And the next morning, when people see the great fish, even the doubters begin to believe in him again. He brings a kind of hope, a kind of redemption to this fallen world, and...
Yes?
Didn't Hemingway write a book like that?
Yes.
The Old Man and the Sea, 1952. A nearly perfect literary parable, so clear, with symbols so available, that the Christian imagery is accessible to even beginning readers. But let's give old Hemingway some credit here. The narrative is more subtle than I've just made it sound. And the struggle is so vivid and concrete that one can get a lot out of it. Triumph over adversity, the value of hope and faith, the attainment of grace, without placing undue weight on the old man, Santiago, as a Christ figure. So, must all Christ figures be as unambiguous as this? No, they don't have to hit all the marks. Don't have to be male, don't have to be Christian, don't even have to be good. See the stories of Flannery O'Connor, for example after example. There, however, we're starting to get into irony, and that's a whole different area where I don't want to go just yet. Yet. But if a character is a certain age, exhibits certain behaviors, provides for certain outcomes, or suffers in certain ways, your literary antennae should begin to twitch. How should we know, though? Here's a handy list, not all-inclusive, but a start. You might be a Christ figure if you are, check any that apply, 33 years old, unmarried, preferably celibate, wounded or marked in the hands, feet, or side, crown of thorns, extra credit, sacrificing yourself in some way for others. Your life is best, and your sacrifice doesn't have to be willing. In some sort of wilderness, tempted there, accosted by the devil. Oh, you get the point. Consult previous list. Are there things you don't have to do? Certainly. Consider Santiago again. Wait, you say, shouldn't he be 33? And the answer is, sometimes that's good. But a Christ figure doesn't need to resemble Christ in every way. Otherwise, he wouldn't be a Christ figure. He'd be, well, Christ. The literal elements, changing water into wine, unless in some clumsy way, such as pouring out someone's water and filling his glass with wine, stretching loaves and fishes to feed 5,000, preaching, although some do, suffering actual crucifixion, literally following in his footsteps, aren't really required. It's the symbolic level we're interested in. Which brings us to another issue we've touched upon in other chapters. Fiction and poetry and drama are not necessarily playgrounds for the overly literal. Many times I'll point out that a character is Christ-like because he does X and Y, and you might come back with, but Christ did A and Z, and his X wasn't like that, and besides, this character listens to AC/DC. Okay, so the heavy metal sound isn't in the hymnal, and this character would be very hard-pressed to take over savior duty. No literary Christ figure can ever be as pure, as perfect, as divine as Jesus Christ. Here, as elsewhere, one does well to remember that writing literature is an exercise of the imagination, and so is reading it. We have to bring our imaginations to bear on a story if we are to see all its possibilities. Otherwise, it's just about somebody who did something. Whatever we take away from stories in the way of significance, symbolism, theme, meaning, pretty much anything except character and plot, we discover because our imagination engages with that of the author. Pretty amazing when you consider that the author may have been dead for 1,000 years, yet we can still have this kind of exchange, this dialogue with her. At the same time, this doesn't indicate the story can mean anything we want it to, since that would be a case of our imagination not bothering with that of the author and just inventing whatever it wants to see in the text. That's not reading, that's writing. But that's another matter, and one we'll discuss elsewhere. On the flip side, if someone in class asks if it's possible that the character under discussion might be a Christ figure, citing 3 or 4 similarities, I'll say something like, works for me. The bottom line, I usually tell the class, is that Christ figures are where you find them, and as you find them. If the indicators are there, then there is some basis for drawing the conclusion. Why, you might ask, are there Christ figures? As with most other cases we've looked at where the work engages some prior text, the short answer is that probably the writer wants to make a certain point. Perhaps the parallel deepens our sense of the character's sacrifice if we see it as somehow similar to the greatest sacrifice we know of. Maybe it has to do with redemption, or hope, or miracle. Or maybe it is all being treated ironically to make the character look smaller rather than greater. But count on it, the writer is up to something. How do we know what he's up to? That's another job for imagination. Chapter 15. Flights of Fancy. I took just enough physics in school to master one significant fact. Human beings cannot fly. Here's a principle that always holds. If it flies, it isn't human. Birds fly, bats fly, insects sometimes fly. Certain squirrels and fish sail for a bit and seem to fly. Humans? 32 feet per second squared. Same as bowling balls. If you drop me and a bowling ball off the Tower of Pisa, and please don't, at the same time, the bowling ball won't go splat. Otherwise, we're the same. Airplanes? No doubt about it. Airplanes and blimps and helicopters and autogyros have changed the way we perceive flight, but for almost all of human history, we've been earthbound. Meaning what? Meaning that when we see a person suspended in the air, even briefly, he is one or more of the following. 1. A superhero. 2. A ski jumper. 3. Crazy. Redundant if also number 2. 4. Fictional. 5. A circus act, departing a canon. 6. Suspended on wires. 7. An angel. 8. Heavily symbolic. Of course, just because we can't fly doesn't mean we don't dream of it. We chafe at laws, particularly when we feel they're unfair or inhibiting or both, as with a law of gravity. The steady winner in magic acts, since most magicians can't afford an elephant for the vanishing act, is levitation. British imperialists in the 19th century came back from the eastern realms with tales of swamis who had mastered the art of hovering above the ground. Our comic book superheroes defy gravity in various ways, whether through flight directly, Superman, tethers, Spider-Man, or gadgets, Batman. Culturally and literarily, we have toyed with the idea of flight since earliest times. Few stories from Greek mythology capture the imagination like that of Daedalus and Icarus, the ingenious father's attempt to save his son from a tyrant, as well as from his own invention, the labyrinth, by coming up with an even more marvelous creation, the solemn parental warning ignored in a burst of youthful exuberance, the fall from a great height, a father's terrible grief and guilt. Flight alone is a wonder, with these other elements, a complete and compelling myth. Other cultures share this fascination. Toni Morrison has spoken of the myth of the flying Africans. The Aztecs saw a particularly important god, Quetzalcoatl, as a snake with feathered wings. Christian popular belief often sees new arrivals in heaven decked out with wings and a harp, emblems of flight and music which are natural properties of the birds, but denied humans. Scripturally, flight is one of the temptations of Christ. Satan asks him to demonstrate his divinity by launching himself from the promontory. Perhaps it is that episode that has associated witchcraft with flight through so much of our history. Or perhaps it is merely that our misplaced desire for flight has turned to envy. So what does it mean when literary characters fly? Take, for example, Morrison's Song of Solomon and its highly ambiguous airborne ending, with milkmen suspended in mid-leap toward guitar, each of them knowing only one can survive. Morrison's use of the myth of the flying Africans introduces a specific historical and racial reference that is outside the experience of most readers, but we recognize various implications. Milkman's great-grandfather, Solomon, flew off to Africa, but couldn't hold on to his youngest child, Jake, dropping him back to earth and slavery. Flying off in this instance suggests casting off the chains of slavery on one level and returning home, Africa for Solomon, Virginia for Milkman, on another. In general, flying is freedom, we might say. Freedom not only from specific circumstances, but from those more general burdens that tie us down. It's escape, the flight of imagination. All of this is very good. Well then, what about Pilot, Milkman's unfortunately named aunt? After she dies, a bird swoops down, grabs the earring box containing a slip of paper with her name on it, and flies away. Milkman suddenly realizes that of all the people he's ever known, Pilot alone had the power of flight, even though she never left the ground. What does it mean to say that someone who remains physically earthbound has been able to fly? It's spiritual, we might conclude. Her soul could soar, which you can't say about anybody else in the novel. She is the character of spirit and love. Her last utterance is a wish that she could have known more people, so she could have loved them all. Such a character is not anchored at all. She's flying in a way we don't need to know the underlying myth of the flying Africans to comprehend. So freedom, escape, return home, largeness of spirit, love. That's a lot for just one work to do with flying. What about others? What about E.T.? When those bicycles leave the street in the Steven Spielberg classic, what's the situation? The adults of the community, representing conformity, hostility to anything new, xenophobia, suspicion, a lack of imagination, are bearing down on our young heroes. They've even set up a roadblock. At just the moment when things look worst, the bicycles leave the earth and, with it, the earthbound grown-ups. Escape? Certainly. Freedom? You bet. Wonder? Magic? Absolutely. It's really pretty straightforward. Flight is freedom. It doesn't always work out that way, but the basic principle is pretty sound. Angela Carter's Nights at the Circus, 1984, offers a comparative rarity, a fictional character who actually possesses wings. Carter's heroine, Fevers, whose name paradoxically suggests both feathers and tethers, is a woman whose flying act has made her the toast of circuses and music halls across Europe. It has also set her apart. She is not like other people, cannot comfortably fit into normal human life. Carter's use of flight differs from Morrison's in that it does not emphasize freedom and escape. Like Franz Kafka's Hunger Artist, Fevers has a gift that places her in a cage. Her flights are contained indoors. Her world is a stage where even the fourth wall is a barrier, since she is so different from her audience that she cannot freely join them. There are a couple of points that should be made here. First, as I have intimated several times before and will discuss later, irony trumps everything. But irony typically depends on an established pattern on which it can work its inversions. All of Carter's irony here, naturally enough, builds on a foundation of expectations having to do with flying and wings. If flying is freedom, and if Fevers' flying represents a kind of counter-freedom, then we have an inversion that creates significance. She's trapped by the ability most symbolic of freedom. Without our expectations about the meaning of flight, Fevers is simply an oddity on a stage. The second point has to do with different kinds of freedom. Just as Morrison's Pilot can fly without ever leaving the ground, so Fevers can find freedom even within the limitations of her fishbowl world. Her act frees her to express her sexuality in ways not available to other women in the novel's highly restricted late Victorian society. She can dress, speak, and act in a manner that would be deeply shocking in other contexts. Her freedom, like her imprisonment, is paradoxical. Carter uses Fevers with her mix of earthy sexuality and avian ability to comment on the situation of women in English society. It's a strategy that is perfectly normal for Carter, whose novels typically and comically undercut assumptions about masculine and feminine roles, holding up our received notions for scrutiny and occasional ridicule. Social criticism is the outcome of this subversive strategy, flight the device by which Carter sets up her ironic notions of freedom and imprisonment. Characters like Fevers, who possess wings, are particularly interesting to us. And why not? How many of your friends and neighbors sport feathers? In truth, stories with winged characters make up a pretty small genre, but those few stories hold a special fascination. Gabriel Garcia Marquez's story, A Very Old Man with Enormous Wings, 1968, features a nameless old man who falls from the sky during a monsoonal rain. His wings are indeed enormous. Some of the poor people in the coastal Colombian town where he lands take him to be an angel, but if he is, he's a very odd one. He's dirty and smelly, and his ragged wings harbor parasites. It is true that shortly after he plops down in the yard of Paleo and Elisanda, their child recovers from a life-threatening fever. But his other miracles, if he has anything to do with them, don't work exactly right. One character fails to recover health, but nearly wins the lottery, while another, although not cured of leprosy, sprouts sunflowers from his sores. Still, the residents are fascinated by this new arrival, so much so that the peasant couple constructs a cage and puts him on display. Although the old man does nothing remarkable, so many people come and pay the small admission fee that Paleo and Elisanda become wealthy. We never know what the old man is, and speculation among the townspeople is hilarious as well as occasionally bizarre. His green eyes suggest to one character that he's a Norwegian sailor. But his hapless, shabby appearance and long-suffering silence clearly benefit the family in a nearly miraculous fashion. In the way of those who receive miraculous aid, they are unappreciative and even a little resentful at having to provide for the old man. Eventually, the old man regains his strength and, seen only by the wife, flaps away, his ungainly flight recalling a rather disreputable vulture more than any angel. Like Carter, Garcia Marquez plays on our notions of wings and flight to explore the situation's ironic possibilities. In fact, he goes even further in some ways. His winged character is literally caged. Moreover, he's dirty and unkempt and bug-ridden, not at all what we expect from potential angels. On one level, the story asks us if we would recognize the second coming if it occurred. And perhaps it reminds us that the Messiah was not generally acknowledged when he did come. The angel doesn't look like an angel, just as the king didn't look like a king, certainly not like the sort of military ruler the Hebrews had expected. Does the old man choose not to fly? Has he been reduced in power and appearance purposely? The story never says, and in its silence, it poses many questions. Of course, his mode of arrival poses another question for us. What about characters who don't quite fly or whose flights are interrupted? Since Icarus, we've had stories of those whose flights end prematurely. In general, this is a bad thing, given what is the opposite of flying. On the other hand, not all crashes end disastrously. At almost the exact same moment, the novels were published within months of each other, Faye Weldon and Salman Rushdie introduced characters, two in each case, falling from great heights from exploding airliners. In Weldon's Hearts and Lives of Men, the contested child of an ugly divorce is kidnapped, and she and her kidnapper float down to safety as the rear section of the plane, containing only the two of them, rather improbably disobeys certain laws of aerodynamics to glide gently to Earth. Rushdie's two main characters, Gabriel and Saladin, fall bodily to the ground, their landing softened by the snow-covered English beach on which they land. In each case, there is an element of rebirth in their cheating what would typically prove to be certain death. The characters are not inevitably better off in their new lives. Rushdie's two are particularly devilish, while Weldon's little girl loses the immense privilege of her previous existence for a very long time, gaining instead the sort of life Dickens would invent for one of his waifs. Nevertheless, the act of falling from vast heights and surviving is as miraculous and as symbolically meaningful as the act of flight itself. As thrilled as we are by the prospect of flying, we are also frightened at the prospect of falling, and anything that seems to defy the inevitability of a plummeting demise sets our imaginations working overtime. The survival of these characters demands that we consider the implications. What does it mean to survive certain death? And how does such survival alter one's relationship to the world? Do the characters' responsibilities to themselves, to life itself, change? Is the survivor even the same person any longer? Rushdie asks outright if birth inevitably involves a fall, while Weldon poses questions that are equally suggestive. If our consideration of flying were limited to those works where characters literally fly, we'd have a pretty thin discussion. These examples of actual flight, necessary as they are, remain valuable chiefly for the instruction they give us in interpreting figurative flight. There's an Irish novel about a little boy growing up to become a writer. As he matures, he finds that in order to acquire the experience and vision he needs to become a writer, he'll have to leave home. Problem: home is an island. The only way he's going to be able to leave is to cross a body of water, which is the most dramatic and final sort of home leaving one can take, and he is a young man with a fear of water. Fortunately, he has the right name to help him out. Daedalus. Not a very Irish name for a young man from Dublin, nor is it the first name he tried for young Stephen, but it's the one James Joyce settled on for A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, 1916. Stephen feels hemmed in by the strictures of Irish life, by family and politics and education and religion and narrow-mindedness. As we know by now, the antidote to limitations and shackles is freedom. The latter parts of the novel are filled with images of birds, feathers, and flying, all of which, while not referring to literal flight, evoke thoughts of metaphorical flight, of escape. Stephen has an epiphany, a Joycean religio-aesthetic word for an awakening, of a waiting girl in which moment he experiences the sensation of beauty and harmony and radiance that convinces him he must be an artist. The girl is neither singularly beautiful nor memorable in herself. Rather, the scene is beautiful in its totality, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say, in his perception of its totality. In this moment, the narration describes her as a bird, from the feathery edges of her drawers to her breast, like that of some dark-plumaged bird. Subsequent to this epiphany, Stephen begins to ruminate on his namesake, the crafter of wings for escape from a different island, whom he comes to think of as hawk-like. Finally, he announces that he must fly past the nets he sees as set to trap him into the conventionality and smallness that is every Dubliner's inheritance. His understanding of flight is purely symbolic, yet his need for escape is no less real for that. In order for him to become a creator, his spirit must soar. He must be free. Indeed, often in literature, the freeing of the spirit is seen in terms of flight. In his poetry, William Butler Yeats often contrasts the freedom of birds with the earthbound cares and woes of humans. In his great The Wild Swans at Cool, 1917, for instance, he watches the beautiful birds rise and wheel, forever young, while he, a middle-aged man, feels the pull of gravity more heavily with each passing year. He makes much of Zeus taking the swan's form to ravish Leda and beget Helen of Troy on her. And he sees the archangel's appearance to the Virgin Mary in terms of wings and birds as well. Similarly, we speak of the soul as taking wing. Seamus Heaney has several poems where the souls of the departed are said to flutter away from the body, and in this he is far from alone. The notion that the disembodied soul is capable of flight is deeply embedded in the Christian tradition, and I suspect in many others as well, although it is not universal. For the ancient Greeks and Romans, such a concept was problematic, since the souls of blessed and damned alike went to an underground realm. But the belief in a celestial heaven leads much of later Western culture to a sense of the soul's lightness. In Birches, Robert Frost imagines climbing the supple birches up toward heaven, then being lightly set back on the ground. And he declares that both going and coming back would be good, even without wings. When Claudius, Hamlet's villainous uncle, tries to pray, he fails, saying, My words fly up, my thoughts remain below. The spirit cannot rise up, Shakespeare suggests, when weighed down by the guilt of an unconfessed murder. When Hamlet lies dead at the play's end, his friend Horatio mourns him, saying, "Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest." As we all know by now, if Shakespeare said it, it must be true. These flights of fancy allow us, as readers, to take off, to let our imaginations take flight. We can sail off with characters, freed of the limitations of our tuition payments and mortgage rates. We can soar into interpretation and speculation. Happy landings.